Today at Reader's Corner, Mitchell Zukov, author of Frozen in Time, an epic story of survival and a modern quest for lost heroes of World War II.
We were shipping hundreds and hundreds of warplanes to England to get into the fight. Perfect stopping place was Greenland. Truly cold to the bone for 5 months. One of the guys suffers terrible frostbite and gangrene. Other guys suffer from various other cold-related injuries. But they held it together. There isn't a person whose name appears in this entire book who didn't sacrifice something of himself to help somebody else. Our goal is to recover John Pritchard, Ben Bottoms, and Lolly Howarth, these three heroes who are entombed in ice to this day.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In November of 1942, a U.S. cargo plane on a routine flight crashed into the Greenland ice cap, setting in motion an extraordinary chain of events. 4 days after the crash, a B-17 searching for the missing cargo plane also went down in a blinding snowstorm. All 9 crew members survived the crash, and an amphibious Grumman Duck was sent on a daring rescue mission to bring them home. After picking up one member of the B-17 crew, the rescuers of this third flight flew into a severe storm and vanished. What followed over the next 5 months is an amazing tale of adventure, survival, and raw courage. Today's guest, Mitchell Zukov, offers a spellbinding account of the fate of the survivors and their would-be rescuers in his book, Frozen in Time, an epic story of survival and a modest quest for lost heroes of World War II. The book also recounts the efforts of modern-day adventurer Lou Sapienza, who worked for years with the Coast Guard to solve the mystery of the Grumman Duck's last flight and recover the remains of its crew. Dr. Zukov returned to Greenland this past summer as part of a new expedition to attempt to recover the remains of the three crew members from their tomb deep beneath the ice. But once again, the attempt was unsuccessful. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Mitchell Zukov. He is a professor of journalism at Boston University, where he teaches narrative writing and investigative journalism. He was a guest on our program in 2011 to discuss one of his earlier books, the New York Times bestseller, Lost in Shangri-La. Dr. Zukov joined us by phone for this interview. Mitchell Zukov, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob. It's so great to be back.
So, you know, it's interesting, when we talk about the greatest generation, and Tom Brokaw made that term very famous, we ordinarily focus on the Pacific theater. We focus on France and Germany. It's not often you think of Greenland. How'd you figure out that there was, if not a war going on, at least the greatest generation doing their part in Greenland?
You know, it's a great point, and it is this enormously overlooked place in every imaginable way, including in terms of when we think about World War II and we think about that great generation. I happened upon it because I had written Lost in Shangri-La, and I was wondering, are there other pieces of the war, these different corners that people have overlooked that somehow sort of slid through the cracks of history? And Greenland caught my eye. First of all, you can't look at a map of the world and not see Greenland.
That's
it's
right.
This giant white spot somewhere between, you know, the U.S. And Europe. And then I started researching it, and it turns out Greenland played this small, overlooked role, partially because of its location, halfway between the States and the continent. You're talking about a place where had Germany opened up bases, they would have been within striking distance of the States. Greenland also was the only natural supply of a mineral called cryolite, which was essential for the production of aluminum, which, of course, was essential for the production of planes. And so the United States wanted to protect this cryolite mine on the southern coastline of Greenland. And then, above all, it was the perfect stopping point when we were shipping hundreds and hundreds of warplanes early in the war from the States, rolling off the production lines, and we have to fly them over to England to get into the fight. The perfect stopping place was Greenland. So this largely overlooked, ice-covered island suddenly became kind of Main Street in between Europe and the States. And so I learned that as soon as we started flying over Greenland, we started flying into Greenland, because the conditions were so awful for the airmen who were, suddenly in charge of these B-17s or these C-47s. And so it was almost inevitable that there would be some kind of story there, and the story that I was fortunate enough to find here was sort of waiting for me. It was frozen in time.
And that really does place the strategy of what's going on in Greenland with the rest of the war. But the other thing that I found so fascinating about this book, and especially the tales of these young men, and some of them were very young men by anybody's standards, is the fact that here these guys are, they're not on the battlefield in Germany or in France, let's say, where the enemy is right over the hill. They're in this remote, unbelievably cold Arctic environment, and yet they're out there doing things, displaying duty, courage, and responsibility, just like their comrades who are on the front lines in France or Germany. And I guess I just have to ask the question, what did you learn about these guys? Why were these guys so driven? Some of them were Coast Guardsmen, or were they not all Coast Guardsmen?
Some were Air Transport Command, but you're making an excellent point, Bob, and it's something that I spent a lot of time thinking about. You know, first, you know, if we think about the youth of these men, these are college-age men who are thrown into this truly world-changing battle, and you know, they were part of it. Even though, you're right, they were not fighting in the trenches, they were not part of a D-Day invasion or battles in France or in Italy, they understood that everybody had a role to play. And in part, their job was to survive, but their job was to be part of this American machine that was going to do nothing less than save the world. And so, you know, the Coast Guardsmen who felt it was their duty to get into this little plane, this ungainly little Grumman Duck rescue plane, and try and get their fellow, you know, soldiers off the ice, they had a motto, and it was, you have to go out, but you don't have to come back. They understood that this was larger than them individually. They had a responsibility, they had a job to do, and their role in this fight was to do what was asked of them, and in this case, it was to save the guys who were out on the ice.
Now, I hate to get this book out of order, but I'm going to do it because, first of all, there's no way in 30 minutes we can cover this book, and that's what makes these programs so interesting for our listeners, because they're always telling me to go out and buy the book to finish the story. I'm going to go to the end of the story, okay. Because what really distinguishes this book and you from many of the people that I have a chance to interview on this show is that the author becomes personally involved. The author becomes part of the story by the time it's all over. So let's flash to not the end, but at least advance through the book to the point where Mitchell is actually making a decision as a journalism professor at Boston University to take a few risks himself, and off he goes to Greenland.
Well, it's not something I went looking for. You know, I thought I was going to tell a great story from history's perspective, but as I was working on the story, I ran into a Coast Guard historian who said, you know, Mitch, there's a guy, Lou Sapienza, who's going to go back and try to find the duck. And I said, really? Is this happening right now? So I got in touch with Lou, and I found out that he was working with the Coast Guard, a terrific Coast Guard commander named Jim Blow. And Jim and Lou were planning this trip. And so I said, well, geez, this would be a great story to tell. But I kind of got swept up in it, as you said, Bob, and in every imaginable way, including when I quickly learned Lou didn't have any financing for this. Lou was a great dreamer and a remarkable guy, but he was completely doing this on a shoestring. And I became so swept up, I gave him the advance from my publisher that was given to me for the book. And when he blew through that, I gave him my credit card number. And it's always a lot of fun, Bob, when your wife gets a phone call from the American Express for
right.
Anti-fraud people wondering if Mitchell really meant to buy all this ammunition and these guns and this anti-polar bear fence. And my wife, you know, Lord bless her, sort of handed me the phone and said, it's for you. And so I got swept up. And so we did, in fact, in 2012, the summer of 2012, go to Greenland and camp out on the glacier to search for the duck.
And so what'd you find?
Well, incredibly, everything went wrong. Well, not incredibly. Greenland's just an inhumane place.
Naturally would be the word, I think.
Yeah, right. And so everything is going wrong, and we're coming to the end of the amount of time we have on the ice before we have to get on this transport plane. And we finally get up to a spot that we've realized there's something special about it. We've got ice-penetrating radar, and we find that there's something, there's an anomaly deep within the ice. And it looks like the signature is metal, and it looks like we can maybe melt down and find something. And just as we get started, we get a call from a satellite phone call from Air Greenland saying, "Everybody off the ice. We've got a terrible, deathly storm coming in." And we're crushed. We're devastated. 17 of us are there. 15 people go back a mile and a half across the glacier to the base camp to await the helicopter. Weegee Smith, our master technician, who is the chief hole melter, declares he's going to stay. He's going to wait. He said, "Have the last helicopter stop on the ice and pick me up. I'm not stopping until the last second." And he looked over to me, and I was the only one there who was kind of independent. I wasn't part of Lou's crew. I wasn't part of the Coast Guard. And I said, "Sure, I'll stay with you." So Weegee and I were the last two men on the ice, and just when everything looked like it was going to end poorly, we dropped a camera 40 feet down into an ice hole we melted, and we found evidence of the duck.
Wow.
And it was the most... other than the birth of my children, it was right up there.
So tell us about the hot sea that I think you used to do that.
This is an ungainly beast. It's about an 800-pound device that Weegee had customized. It's basically a hot water pressure washer that you would use to, you know, strip barnacles off of boats or get graffiti off of walls. He modified it in a way that he could use it to actually use the glacier against itself. He superheats the frozen glacier and then runs it through these pipes and then melts down into the ice. And we had to move this thing. We called for a helicopter. Air Greenland couldn't get out there because of the storm. So the 17 of us had to move this beast on skis, basically. Weegee had turned these aluminum ladders into skis for the machine, and we had to push it uphill across a glacier a mile and a half, crossing crevasses, fearing hidden crevasses. It was the most physically arduous work I'd ever done. And we got the hot sea up to this key location, this key point of interest, and we began melting with it. And the hot sea was our savior in many ways.
Mm-hmm. So you detect the duck, then what happens?
Well, we detect the duck, and then we had to leave. We find these pieces, we photograph the evidence that we can, but literally the storm is coming and our time is done. So we immediately, upon getting home, start planning a return trip for this year, because our goal, as you said in the open, is to recover these three men, John Pritchard, Ben Bottoms, and Lolly Howarth, these three heroes who are entombed in ice to this day. So we made a plan to go back this summer, and tragically, you know, I was there for a month in August, and we still have not finished the job. So my hope is we're going to be going back again next year.
You're listening to Mitchell Zukov. He's the author of Frozen in Time, an epic story of survival and a modern quest for lost heroes of World War II. Well, let's go back to the beginning. The chain of events all starts on November 5th, 1942. What was this C-53 cargo plane doing out there to begin with? Where was it going, and what was its mission?
Sure. Because of all the things that were happening around Greenland and Iceland on the way to England, there were constantly supply flights running between the two islands. So Homer McDowell and his crew of five are flying back from Iceland, from Reykjavik, over back towards Greenland. And they encounter this experience that pilots call flying in milk. And it's this terrible thing where you're flying over Greenland and the earth and sky, or the snow and sky, blend into one color. You cannot tell the ground from the sky because everything is the same shade of gray. And altimeters in those days, you know, didn't tell them their height over the land. It told them the height over over sea level. So you would be flying along and not realizing you were flying almost directly into the rising ice cap. And so McDowell, incredibly, is able to land his plane with four others aboard on the ice cap. The plane is intact. All five men survive, and they start making radio calls, SOS calls. They know there's no way to survive. They have very few rations. They have no real survival gear. So immediately, the military, as soon as they get these calls, they start detouring planes that are bound for the war, planes like a B-17 bomber, you know, our big flying fortress, suddenly gets turned into a search and rescue plane. At this point, they were so desperate to find these guys, they just wanted eyes in the sky, because it was understood that in no time, the plane would be buried by snow. In no time, it's November, so snowstorms can be almost a daily event in Greenland. They knew that these guys would be cold and hungry and desperate. And so whatever plane they had, they put up in the air. 4 days after, on November 9th, 1942, this B-17 was supposed to be delivering their plane to England, and instead they got turned into this search team, and they're flying up the East Coast in a place called Koji Bay, and they, again, the same experience. They encounter flying in milk. And Armin Monteverdi at the controls is forced to make a terrible decision. He dips the left wing of this B-17 bomber, and immediately, thinking that he's about 1,000 feet atop the glacier, over the glacier, he's only about 100 feet over the glacier. And the left wing clips the top of the ice, and the plane bounces down onto its belly, onto the glacier. It's running across, like, almost like a giant bobsled, across the ice, carving a groove into the top of the ice. It's going across crevasses. It breaks in half. Literally, the plane breaks in half behind the wings, and guys are thrown around, thrown into the ice. And when it comes to rest, the plane is in two giant pieces. It's destroyed. Incredibly, all nine men aboard this B-17 are still alive. Several are hurt. But now, suddenly, 4 days apart, we have two American planes down on the ice cap of Greenland with guys desperate for survival.
Mm-hmm. And this is where the Grumman comes in.
Exactly. They're spotted. It takes 2 weeks. And over the course of those 2 weeks, this incredible young man who's again, like the age of our college students, Lauren Lolly Howarth, rebuilds the radio in the B-17. And incredible. His hands are curling in pain from the cold, but he just works constantly and gets the radio working, puts out an SOS, and a legendary flyer named Bert Balkin, who was one of the early Arctic flyers who had taught Amelia Earhart how to use instruments in flying, just a real legend. He is actually a colonel now at this point in the American military. He commandeers a plane and goes and finds these guys. He spots them from the air. And then the call goes out to the Coast Guard. Hey, you guys have an amphibious plane that maybe you can figure something out. And there, the Coast Guard, John Pritchard and Benjamin Bottoms, the pilot and crewman, the radio man of the Grumman Duck, decide, we're going to land this, we're going to do what's never been done before. We're going to land this little amphibious plane on a glacier, rescue these guys, and then take off and land back in the water next to our ship, the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Northland. They actually do it. The first day they go is November 28, 1942. They land on the glacier, they go across the ice, and they reach the crew, and they grab two of the guys who are hurt but able to walk. They get them back to the Grumman Duck, and they fly off back to the Northland. Those guys are safe. The next day, Pritchard and Bottoms get back into their Grumman Duck. They fly to the ice cap, and Lolly Howarth, the radio man, gets aboard the Grumman Duck. They're going back to try and get out and get help before the storm comes in. But tragically, the storm beats them to it. And again, Pritchard flies into milk, and the plane disappears. And so at that point, the remaining men on the B-17, plus a motor sled driver who reaches them but can't get out, they're faced with the realization nobody else is coming for them. And much of the book covers what really happens over the next 5 months as these guys figure out how to survive in really the worst place on Earth, living underneath the wing of a B-17 or in snow caves that they dig, surviving on rations that are dropped to them from the sky. And essentially, they understand that if they're going to make it, they have to make it on their own, and they have to survive until spring when another attempt can be made to get them.
Now, most of this story must be because these two guys that got out were able to relate it.
That's a big part of it, absolutely. But because some of the guys, it turns out, incredibly, Bert Balkin was able to get back to these guys with a bigger float plane the following spring. And one of them, and I'm not going to give the name because if readers, I don't want readers to know who makes it and who doesn't.
Sure, sure.
But one of these guys actually wrote a 40-page, single-spaced account of what happened to him. A couple of the other guys later, who survived, told their stories, and I was able to gather them. And this is, it's complete nonfiction. Everything is documented in terms of what I say happened as these guys were fighting for survival, struggling to stay alive. And above all, and this is really, to me, this is the real takeaway of the book, self-sacrificing for each other. Whatever it took, these guys said, I'm going to save the guy next to me before I worry about myself. And the ones who do survive, and the only reason any of them survived, frankly, is because so many of these guys took that attitude and took that approach, and at great risk and in some cases at great cost to themselves.
When they came back to land that plane, they couldn't exactly land the plane near the B-17, could they?
No, they couldn't, in fact. It's a great point. They had to find a place that wasn't, cross-hatched with all these crevasses, these deep gashes in the ice. So they had to go, in one case, a mile or so away, and then cross this incredibly treacherous landscape of crevasses and hidden, what we call moulins. It's bad enough that you're in a landscape where you have these 100-foot or 200-foot gashes in the ice, but they're hidden by ice bridges. What happens is when a snowstorm comes, it almost turns it into like a trap door. And so there'll be a thin layer at the top where you look across the ice and it looks solid. But if you step in the wrong spot, the bottom falls out. And in many cases, you fall to your death.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Mitchell Zukov. He's the author of Frozen in Time, an epic story of survival and a modern quest for lost heroes of World War II. Now, when this last Grumman duck came in for the final rescue, there were three men remaining, I believe, and it was several weeks later because of weather and all that. Describe how these guys end up surviving.
The guys who survive end up digging. Well, some of them stay in the tail section of the B-17 until it looks like it's going to fall into a crevasse, and then they dig out a little kind of almost like an igloo underneath the wing of the plane. Now, they realize they think they're not going to survive the entire winter there. So a group of them head off toward a little shack that they know of, a little weather shack that's maybe 12 miles away across the ice. Well, their motor sled breaks down, and they have to actually just dig in underneath the ice, truly like an igloo, and hole up there. And only because there was another B-17 pilot, a guy named Pappy Turner, who made it his duty, his business, to keep these guys alive. Throughout the winter, he would fly overhead and drop them supplies. He couldn't land, he couldn't get to them, but he dropped them supplies, dropped them walkie-talkie radios throughout the winter, flying through storms, and kept them alive until they could try this other rescue.
In all, how long were they stranded there on Greenland's ice cap?
The longest group was 148 days, 5 months. And again, Bob, having been there, for a month in August, and it's relatively calm and temperate. We had the best supplies you can imagine, tents and great sleeping bags, et cetera, and heaters, propane heaters. And it was tough.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm soft, but too much time in the classroom, I guess. But it's unimaginable to me because there's a kind of core coldness that sets in, where you're just truly cold to the bone. And these guys had to do that for 5 months. And in one case, one of the guys suffers terrible frostbite and gangrene and actually loses both of his feet to that. Other guys will suffer from various other cold-related injuries. But they held it together. And, I mean, the bravery and the self-sacrifice, as I said a little earlier, it never ceases to amaze me.
But I guess that leads to a question about what happens after this is all over, and these guys, I mean, their heroism, their courage is well accounted for, obviously everybody missed it. I mean, these guys went back to being whoever they were before the war, I guess, and that was that?
You know, it's amazing. I think, you know, today they each would have written books. They would have been on the TV show Survivor. You know, they would have done
exactly.
Tonight Show. I think it's not exaggerating to say it was a self-effacing time. It was not about self-aggrandizement. They understood that there were guys all over the planet, literally, and you said it in the open, you know, about what was happening in the Pacific or what was happening in North Africa or in Europe. There were people sacrificing and risking their lives every single day. These guys did not see themselves as special or as heroes. They were obviously enormously glad that they survived. They were proud of that. But they understood there was something much, much bigger than themselves going on. And so they were not calling attention to themselves. In fact, a number of them, the ones who were healthy enough, went right back to doing the work that they were assigned to. They went back to flying planes from the factories, from bases in the States, over to Europe to get them into the war. They sort of dissolved into the background.
And, of course, so many years have passed and so many members of the Greatest Generation have left us. But I remember you're talking about Lou Sapienza's efforts and the fact that he wanted to get this done for the sister of one of these of these victims and one of these heroes. Tell us about that. That's kind of a human interest angle to this story,
yeah.
I guess.
You know, John Pritchard was the pilot of the Grumman Duck, and he was a genuine hero. He had already rescued a group of Canadian flyers who were down on the ice cap. He was already in line for a medal for that when he went out to save the B-17 crew. And he had a younger sister named Nancy, and Nancy was about 8 years younger than John. She looked up to him. He was her hero. She would eventually go on to marry his best friend. And Nancy is now 91 years old, and she's wonderfully spry and sharp and in great health. But she's been waiting literally her whole life, 70-odd years, to be able to bury her beloved older brother on American soil. And Lou made it, Lou, you know, this private adventurer, private expedition leader, made it his duty, his challenge, to satisfy that desire that she had. And so whenever we would sort of have rough days on the ice or rough days planning the mission, Lou and I think all of us reached the point where we just said, you know, this is for Nancy. This is not about us. It's not about, you know, figuring out how to deal with the budgets and all. This is for Nancy.
So when you go back next summer, Mitch, is there anything that will be done differently than the way you guys have approached it previously?
Absolutely. We have a plan for next summer that's going to be much more direct drilling and melting because we know where it is. We know where the bird is. We know where the duck is. And we know where that the men can't be far away from the pieces we saw. And so we are going to get there earlier in the season to avoid some of the weather problems. And we're going to get right down to work and right down to the melting. And Lord willing, we will be coming home next year with those men.
And we'll have a book. You'll be back on the show, the book Unfrozen in Time. How about that?
I like it.
All right,
like
we'll do it. Great. Mitch, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book is Frozen in Time, an epic story of survival and a modern quest for lost heroes of World War II. Mitchell Zukoff, the author, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Mitchell Zukoff. Next week, Adam Rome, author of The Genius of Earth Day, How a 1970 Teach-In Unexpectedly Made the First Green Generation. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.